Hello and welcome to the Manchester Is Red podcast. My name is Stephen Railston. We're recording this episode on a Monday morning, just a day after Manchester United drew 2-2 with Liverpool at Old Trafford on Sunday afternoon. Samuel, you are at the game. You're here with me on this podcast, as usual, my partner in crime. First of all, how are you? I know you don't really like the pleasantries, but are you all right?
I do like the pleasantries, but...
You always tell me to skip it.
Skip the preamble, get into the football. I think people listening are just like, get stuck into it,
Another chaotic game. You keep making the joke that there's always the drama.
I didn't think it was as chaotic.
Oh, well,
because of what we'd experienced at Brentford and Chelsea. It didn't feel as chaotic, weirdly.
Well, it's been a chaotic season. It's been a chaotic few results since the international break. Obviously, I mean, the Liverpool game was an incredible game at Old Trafford, the 4-3. Then we go to Chelsea, we'll have the Brentford games, more. Yeah, just absolute chaos. Agents of chaos. How many more times do I have to say the word chaos? But it felt like that.
I agree, it was. I think some United fans would have, but it wasn't a good result for them. It was a worse result for Liverpool. United fans were able to extract the satisfaction of potentially scuppering a Liverpool title as they did 5 years ago. And the fact that Klopp was getting chided with the chant of Jürgen's cracking up, and he got it again as he approached the tunnel at full time, and he cupped his ear, and that song first was invented by United fans about Rafael Benitez, which was Rafa's cracking up back in 2009. The difference back then was that United were title challengers and they won the title. They're barely worthy of the status of also-rans now. So that gives you an idea of how far they've fallen. But in terms of the game, in terms of football and surprising you or just leaving your jaw falling to the floor, how United didn't lose that game after the first half, that is quite the achievement in some ways. I mean, it was an achievement that they lost that game at Chelsea, having entered added time and the olaying whilst passing the ball. It was almost like, fair play, you've lost that in a way. It's impressive to lose that. It was impressive that they didn't lose against Liverpool. And for all the... pseudo intellectual takes on football and all these buzz phrases and all the claptrap that gets talked about tactics at times, there are three reasons why that game ended 2-2 yesterday. Two great goals and Liverpool losing their nerve, because Liverpool should have battered United. They did batter United, but you could tell looking at Klopp's body language, and normally when Liverpool miss a chance, Klopp is always clapping enthusiastically. It doesn't matter if it's not gone in or not. He's really encouraging them. Yesterday, you could tell at 1-0, when they were missing chances, he was starting to get... He was quite vexed by it, because the memory of what happened 3 weeks ago is still fresh. And while there was only a goal in it, there was a glimmer of hope for United. One careless pass, one amazing finish later, it's 1-1. And suddenly the dynamic of the game changed. Another great goal later, and there'd have been some Liverpool fans in the away end who must have thought, for Christ's sake, this is history repeating itself. And maybe it would have done, but for a pretty clumsy to say the least, from Aaron Wan-Bissaka, that tackle. I know there are a lot of online United fans who would always contest refereeing decisions, and it was such a bad tackle, he didn't properly clean out Harvey Elliott, and Elliott did buy it, but it was a dreadful tackle and it was a penalty. There's no debating about it. So in the end, it was a result that just didn't suit either side. It's got to the point now where, with United and European competition, the question is whether they're in the Europa League or the Europa Conference League next season, because we know they're not going to qualify for the Champions League, even though it's still not mathematically impossible, and Villa are wobbling, as they've been wobbling for a while, and that's the problem. Villa have been wobbling for a while, and United are not just below them, they're still 11 points behind them.
It's a really intense start to a game. I mean, really entertaining, really watchable, electric. And Garnacho obviously had the ball in the back of the net. Great finish. Fernandez should have played that pass a little bit sooner.
We knew from where the press box is, we had a great view of that. And before Garnacho put the ball in, we knew the flag was going up. And it was Fernandez's fault. He didn't need to delay it. And that was a pity for United, because they've had fast starts against Liverpool in the previous two games at Old Trafford under Erik ten Hag, and they've always got a goal. They didn't yesterday, but in the first 10 minutes, it was looking quite promising. They were on the front foot. They did have that opening. Liverpool did look unnerved. I thought Conor Bradley, who was very vulnerable against Brighton a week before, I mean, Ten Hag even raised his index finger at one point. It was pointing over that way. And the way I read that was, you know, play it down that side because he's the one to target. And as I said, he did get booked early on, but they never really followed up on that, it didn't feel like. And that was because Liverpool, as soon as they, you know, they didn't necessarily weather the storm as such, but after that period, they just took the sting out of the game and they controlled it. And normality was restored. And that was the way it played out until the 50th minute. And that poor pass by Quansah and that wonderful finish by Fernandes.
Yeah, I think it was after 10 minutes that Liverpool just started to, you know what, calm heads, keep the ball, started to knock it around. And they just looked like a title chasing team. And United looked like a team who are struggling to
compete. We've got Thursday nights.
Yeah, and coming in that rubbish Europa season. League yeah. music and coming. And as you say, the memories of the kind of the game and the FA Cup started to come back around. It comes into half time. Liverpool had 14 shots to United 0. And you look at the stats, you look at the game, and I just thought, they can't get anything out of this. Come out second half, 5 minutes in, Konsa makes that mistake. What a finish from Fernandes or Samuel. The technique.
Oh, it was amazing.
I think the technique is just underrated because if you watch that, you don't really think about it. But the way he actually strikes that ball first
time. It's very specific, isn't it?
It's brilliant. He's not such a good goal.
Yeah, he's not just seen him and just thought, oh, I'll just take a pot shot here. The way he strikes the ball, the technique on it, I thought Troy Deeney actually analysed it quite well in that, you know, it's his first time and he's actually cut across it as well. He's hit the ball in a very specific way to ensure that he's not getting too much loft on it so it doesn't go over the bar. He's getting the precision right on it. And it was so precise that it just went past Kelleher's glove. And it would have been interesting had he saved it because he'd have been sent off. He'd have had to have been sent off. And United would have had a man advantage. And okay, they'd have still been 1-0 down. But in that instance, obviously, you take the goal, you want the goal in that very moment. And it was kind of typical of Fernandes in a way, in that when he is so bad, he can then be good. And that wasn't good yesterday. That was brilliant. And I thought in the first half he was egregious. He was so bad. He started badly with the delayed pass and he just didn't get any better. I think there was a quote from Gary Neville where he said, I think it was on the BBC's live blog, that he said that Casemiro and Fernandes, for players of their experience, are doing things that are beyond me. Like they were doing things that you wouldn't associate with an experienced player. But one of the many perks of having Fernandes in your team is that however badly he may be playing, he is always liable to do something. And like with the Antony equaliser in the cup game, United got an equaliser with something out of nothing. And that's why Klopp, as people would have seen watching the game and we saw from the press box, that's why he was so tightly wound yesterday, because Liverpool, they almost allowed lightning to strike twice. In a way, it kind of did, just the fact that they gave the game away. They had a 5-on-2 at one point as well, which they botched, which was an opportunity they had in the cup game. And it was a bad result for them. It was a better result for United than it was for Liverpool by far and away. And it wasn't a particularly good result for United in the grand scheme of things.
The intensity returned after that equaliser. The game kind of exploded back into life. It was United weren't performing well and obviously had momentum. And I was surprised at how rattled Liverpool got. Probably because of that result 3 weeks ago. They lost their heads and they thought, oh my God, it's happening again.
I think they've only won once at Old Trafford under Klopp as well. And Klopp will have managed there, I think, eight or nine times.
Has he been in charge of Liverpool?
Yeah, he took over in October 2015, but they've had a Europa League tie there, they've had an FA Cup tie there, so it's probably 8 or 9 games. And the only win he's had was the 5-0, of course, which effectively spelt the end for Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. And it was interesting that Jamie Carragher wrote a column in the Telegraph on Saturday morning about how, you know, essentially it was an original angle in that, although there was this consensus that Liverpool were going to just beat United, he said, well, Liverpool teams have gone to Old Trafford before, fancied themselves, and they've frozen. And that has happened a little bit with Klopp's teams. It certainly happened twice this season. It certainly happened last season when they hadn't lost a domestic game all year. United had that two awful results against Brighton and Brentford at the start of the season. And then they played out their skins and they somehow beat Liverpool, and certainly in the first 20 or 30 minutes they absolutely overwhelmed them. So United have had it in them to do that to Liverpool. Klopp's Liverpool, I mean, they had a bad result there when they drew 0-0 against Solskjaer's United in, it would have been February 2019, and United players were dropping like flies that day. Not much has changed there, I suppose. So yeah, it's interesting in that, you know, Klopp has never, I don't think he's ever lost against United at Anfield, but Old Trafford, bar that pretty, you know, that once in a lifetime 5-0 victory, they've more often than not come a cropper, irrespective of who's been in the dugout for United.
Let's talk about Kobbie Mainoo then as well, because we're running out of superlatives, I think, for Kobbie Mainoo. We've absolutely praised him to the high heavens on this podcast all season. He's been exceptional. He was probably struggling a bit in that first half. Gary Neville was picking up on his positioning a lot in the first 45 minutes, and I kind of felt that was unfair, because I think what he was saying was correct, but it was orders from Ten Hag. He was kind of shadowing McAllister and Matt Markin, and there was space being left in midfield. But again, as we keep saying, that's a structural issue, not a personnel one. Mm-hmm. But the goal, takes a touch, gets out of his feet, swivels, top right corner. Absolutely stunning.
Again, Deeney's analysis of that was interesting. Then he said that his position was brilliant, and that he could have gone any one of three or four ways, I think it was. He could have gone down the line, he could have turned inside, he could have gone outside, and we were right behind it, and as soon as he hit it,
as he hit it, he kind of walked away.
It was the sweetest shot he's hit in his life. It must be the first time he scored at Old Trafford. I don't think he scored. Did he score in any of the Youth Cup games? I'm not sure he did, because they played most of their games at Old Trafford that season a couple of years ago. But I think that's another string to his bow. Not so much scoring, but for 60 minutes, I think Liverpool neutered him in that game, and he didn't affect it. He was influential against Liverpool 3 weeks ago, and clearly they took measures to ensure that wasn't going to happen again. And the first half passed him by, as it passed by a lot of United players. They had to get used to not having the ball, and when they did have the ball, more often than not, they were quite wasteful with it. As I've said before, you cut Mainoo and Garnacho slack because they're teenagers, and the experienced players should be supporting them more, and they haven't done that this season. But I don't think it's a surprise that Mainoo has that resilience to overcome a difficult hour, or certainly a difficult half at the very least, and then still come up with a bit of magic like he did yesterday. And he's got three goals this season. His United career only really properly began in November as well. And for someone who's you'd probably say he's a deep-lying midfield playmaker, I think that's pretty reasonable going to have scored three goals. And I mean, two of the goals have been wonderful goals, the goal of the month against Wolves, and he's already come up with a contender for goal of the month for April.
I have heard that's where some people believe he should be kind of striving to improve and getting goals and maybe assisting in the final third, but that will naturally come as he plays in a bit more of a prominent position, because I just saw this season he's been used as a number six quite a bit. I know it's kind of blending in from number eight these days. In terms of the wider picture then of what this result means, you said it's not a brilliant result for United. I'd argue fans would have taken a point at the start of the game, but as you just said before, it's kind of spoiling Jurgen Klopp's last season. And that in itself, if you're a Man United fan, is brilliant.
That's what a fan...
FA Cup, get them out of the competition. And if the Klopp win the title, even better.
That's exactly what a fan who was at the game said to me yesterday. He said, you know, he kind of does... The whole concept of Champions League qualification, finishing in the top four, wasn't even in his mind. It's about, on the day, you want to beat Liverpool. And of course, they want that, and they came reasonably close to doing that yesterday. And if it does, you know, contribute to wrecking Klopp's long goodbye, then that'll be an added bonus, and they'll know that for a fact in what, 6 or 7 weeks' time, when it's the when we're doing the post-mortems from the final day of the season. But as I said, in the grand scheme of things, the fact that we're not even really talking about United and top four or top five anymore is telling. You can't back a manager on the basis of getting a draw against Liverpool, and that's, you know, ultimately that this is, they've had one win in their last six in the Premier League. So the response to that draw yesterday, that result, wasn't a surprise. I mean, they weren't going to get booed off. They weren't going to get pelters for recovering from that first half. And I thought the reception they got at half time was very supportive, very generous as well. There wasn't any booing. And there's been a lot of booing at Old Trafford this season when they've been losing, whether it's during the second half or at full time. At half time, there have been boos a number of times as well. But there was a different atmosphere yesterday. And those supporters had a lot more to cheer about 5 minutes into the second half and then again in the 67th minute. I think what's interesting at the moment with Ten Hag is that when he re-emerged yesterday for the second half and the game had restarted, he lingered for quite a while, applauding the fans and then beckoning them to support the team. It's got to the point now where he needs them more than they need him. 2 years ago, United fans needed Ten Hag a lot more than the other way around. Now he's conscious, I think he's quite conscious that he's got the support of the matchgoers. They've not turned on him. And it's not out of character for United fans to turn on the mantra either. They flew a banner over Old Trafford on David Moyes' final game in charge at home, saying wrong one, Moyes out. That was a minority of fans, but still the point was made. Louis van Gaal was specifically booed when they lost to Southampton, and Ole Gunnar Solskjaer was specifically booed when he approached the away end, having entered the end game effectively at Watford that time. But because Ten Hag has banked goodwill from last season, and because there is an element of sympathy for him, and there is an understanding as well of the nuances of being Manchester United manager and what he's had to deal with during his time, and also because United have still got an FA Cup to play for, there is still some enthusiasm among supporters that they can have a good end to the season. And look, they were singing about Wembley again yesterday because that's what their focus is on. That they'd rather talk and sing about the FA Cup more than the Premier League at the moment. But the Premier League season, I think, is right off now. And speaking to another supporter who's ASA, he raised the decent point that United have got Bournemouth away on Saturday, Villa play Arsenal on the Sunday, and then United's next two Premier League games are at home to the worst teams in the league, Sheffield United and Burnley. So that's not, you put that, you look at it that way and you think, well, there's still a reasonable chance they could get fifth, and fifth is likely to get Champions League qualification. But nobody is going to be talking about that at length. I'd like to think I'm not talking about it at length as such. But nobody has faith that United are going to be winning three games on the spin and Villa are going to be dropping points left, right and centre, and that United get into the Champions League that way. I think a lot of United fans are just past the point of caring as far as the league season is concerned. And that's not a good position for the manager to be in when we've just entered April and there are still seven league games left. So they've still got, 21 points to play for. But they're getting cut adrift now. And as I said earlier, they've only won one of their last six league games and they've lost 17 games this season, won 21 games. I don't think inconsistent really is... I think inconsistent would be kind on them. I'm consciously not using that as a word to describe them. When you lose 70... I don't think they've lost 17 games in the season since 1989 to 90. And if United fans are looking for an omen, that season, of course, ended with them winning the FA Cup.
So you're telling me they're going to win the FA Cup?
Well, yes, yeah.
Manchester City in the final. It could be Chelsea. That's the thing. I mean, Chelsea are a basket case club.
And, yes, you know, as they demonstrated again yesterday.
Performed well against City this season on a few occasions. Mm-hmm. We'll leave it there for part one and we'll be back in a moment for part two. Welcome back to part two of the Manchester Is Red podcast. We'll delve into some individual performances, as usual, Samuel, in the second part. Willy Kambuala, really good, I thought. Obviously made his debut against West Ham in December. Big things were expected when he came to the club in 2020. He came with a big reputation, $4 million for a youngster is a lot of money.
Would he have been 16 at the time then as well?
And I'll put my hands up when I've watched a lot of them in the academy and I never really thought he'd make that transition. I often thought he was a bit clumsy and prone to a mistake actually, but he's really impressed his stepping up this season. And he obviously, to be fair, he had a lot of injury problems in the academy which kind of halted his progress. But he seems to have kicked on this season. there was that moment in the first half when the ball went over the top. He kind of mistimed it, got it wrong, but he recovered. Darwin Nunez, that was fantastic. Do you know what I love about him? He goes up to the crowd, he fist pumps to the crowd. He's kind of got this kind of infectious personality. He seems really likable. And the crowd have really taken to that as well.
Yeah, they're bound to. There are some others, more senior players. There's one senior player. Whenever they break off from the lineup, Dalot always charges over. I've spoken to one or two fans in the Stretford end who say, "Wine smells high heaven." Like the onus is there on them to perform, not the supporters to perform. But I'm really pleased with Kambwala because, as you said, his first 3 years at the club were pretty much a write-off. Certainly, the night they won the FA Youth Cup, he was there possibly the most expensive signing for the academy, and he was there in his Paul Smith suit because he wasn't going to get a look in, and I don't think he played any part in that FA Youth Cup run that season due to injury. And fortunately for him, he's come into the fold because of the number of defensive injuries they've had. And less than 4 months ago, he'd still not been named in a United matchday squad. He got that opportunity at Anfield, and now his United career so far has been bookended by Liverpool away, being on the bench, then Liverpool at home starting the game. And it was a very creditable performance. I thought he was pretty good at West Ham 2 days before Christmas. He came in difficult circumstances and acquitted himself very well for someone who'd literally never played a professional game before. And you look at the profile of him, and I did quite a big piece on him not long after he signed, because he signed on deadline day in October 2020. And the profile suggested that, well, this is a logical acquisition. It was that final window they had the opportunity to sign players under the age of 18 from overseas clubs before the Brexit regulations kicked in, which is why they signed Garnacho, Alvaro Fernandez, Mark Jurado, and then Willy Kambwala in that same summer. And I don't think many people would have expected Kambwala to be one of the players who's still in the reckoning. And I think also Maguire deserves credit. Yes, Simon Maguire's had five different central defensive partners this season, and he was very good. And he's clearly a pretty good mentor for young players. Held the fort, and when that what you referenced earlier, that recovery challenge that Kambwala put in against Nunez, I mean, Ten Hag was even applauding him. And Ten Hag's not exactly his penchant to applaud individuals for an act of that's worthy of applause during the game. I mean, Klopp does that. Arteta will do that. Guardiola sometimes does that. But Ten Hag's not renowned for it. So when you do get that from him, you've done something really well. I mean, Onana got it at Brentford the previous week for the double save. I think Ten Hag clenched his fists and applauded him. So it's good going for Kambwala, as I said, especially given that the first 3 years were pretty much a write-off. I've not actually checked how many times he played for the academy during that period, but I'd be surprised if it's between 20 and 30. I mean, you may have done your research there ahead of me, but you're shaking your head.
There was two brilliant quotes from the game I thought about Willy Kambwala. The first one was before the match, and Ten Hag was speaking to MUTV, and he said, "Willy is doing very well." So that was the first one.
That's a brilliant quote.
Well, if you've got the joke, but we'll move on. And then the press conference, he said, "When all soldiers die, new ones have to come in."
That was a very good quote. Yeah.
Does that mean Raphael Varane and Johnny Evans are dead?
I'd like to think not for their sake, but
got families.
Yeah, exactly. But it was quite a nice. It was unusual for Ten Hag. He doesn't use the terms of phrases like that, or offers analogies that colourful. And it also indicates that the medical department have rather failed in their duties to keep these old soldiers young. I mean, I think Evans has done really well this season, but he is breaking down as often as you'd expect an overplayed 36-year-old to do. So Varane's issues are well documented, to the point that he came out and spoke to L'Equipe last week about the damage that he's done to his body. And when you talk that way, do you expect to stay on when your contract's up in a couple of months? It's doubtful. But at least Ten Hag does have this faith in young players, and he did that. I don't think anybody going into the game yesterday, I don't think anybody was expecting Kambwala not to start. it was pretty obvious that Evans and Varane were not going to recover. And why would you turn to an auxiliary option?
He said in his interview, didn't he, pre-match,
Casemiro
potentially could have dropped the midfielder into
because Casemiro did start against Burnley in the League Cup last season.
So if McTominay had been fit,
there's that question, possibility.
Would have Casemiro played centre-half and McTominay midfield?
Well,
very potentially.
Possibly. I'd like to think not, because I think playing McTominay with Maynou against Liverpool 3 weeks on, it's tantamount to just crossing your fingers and hoping for the best. There was, like, the ends justified the means 3 weeks ago, but it was moments. United are a moments team. That result yesterday, it had very little to do with the manager. He was always going to select Fernandes and Maynou. They score brilliant goals. Liverpool lose their nerve. That is literally why the game ended 2-2, as you said, chaotic as it was. And it was just a really, really strange game that United had one of their worst first halves at Old Trafford in living memory, just going off the sheer dominance that Liverpool enjoyed, and then to actually only concede one more goal and score two themselves in the second half was pretty impressive. And I suppose it's not much consolation, because they did concede late on again, but they didn't concede an added time goal for once. And that will have done Kambuala the power of good as well, that there was some resilience about United yesterday, and there has been some resilience about them all season. You don't look at them and think this is a team that lack commitment, that are not playing for the manager, are not behind the manager. They are. There's just no structure and there's no style, and it's difficult to tell what they're being coached on a weekly basis at Carrington.
I'm going to tease some more effusive praise from you for Harry Maguire now, because maybe 2 months back I suggested he's had a really good season. I think I said, and you were like, hey, he's had an all right season. But then I was on one with Tyrone and we were talking about his character and how he's kind of bounced back from all the criticism and kind of being that joke pantomime figure. And me and Tyrone really praised him to that, Samuel. So it's your turn now to hold your hands and go, do you know what? He actually has been pretty consistent this year.
I think when you asked me that question, I went through in minute detail about his February, which had consisted of a good performance against West Ham that was blemished by two mistakes where he got bailed out by bad finishing or a tackle by Dallow. Very good against Villa, where I thought he was probably the man of the match. At Luton the next week, he gets booked and hooked at half-time because there's a chance to get sent off. And then against Fulham, he got a goal, but then he was culpable for Fulham's winning goal. So it was a variable month. And unfortunately for him, he's had some very ill-timed injury issues this season. He got injured against Bayern Munich, didn't he, in December. Having been on a long starting run, got a good ovation from the United fans when he went off. And then he got injured after the Fulham game, wasn't it, when he would have started against Forest, City, Everton. But then when he came on against Liverpool, I thought he was terrific. I mean, he was a defensive substitution, but he was a real attacking asset that day. I thought he beefed up the defence against Brentford. And unfortunately for him, I think had they not collapsed against Chelsea, he'd have probably been getting an 8 out of 10 rating. Because I thought, in fact, he might still have got an 8. I can't remember. Amid the chaos and the franticness of that finale, whether I did change his mark. But I thought he was really good at Chelsea. So I think I think when I did the ratings of the season a few weeks ago, he was given a 6, which I'd have stood by at that time. At the moment,
a bit harsh.
Well, I mentioned
what,
that.
What was Varane then? Out of interest,
Varane was a 6 as well.
Evans,
Evans was an 8. There were 3 8s. Evans, Maynou, and Garnett.
I don't think there should be such a difference between Maguire and Evans and an 8 and a 6. Maguire's actually been really consistent.
As I always stress at the bottom for those who cannot, I'm not saying one has been better than the other. The marks, it's like a school teacher doing a school report. I'm not saying you're better than him, but this is an individual mark assigned to you. He's Maguire since the end of the March internationals. He's probably creeping towards a 7 at the moment. And the likelihood is that he's going to start pretty much every game in the running the way it's going. I don't see, unless he gets injured, which would be a real disaster for United because every other senior centre-half is injured, then he's starting every game and therefore I'd say he's probably definitely staying for next season. Then you look at next year and you think, well, maybe that's the time to sell him next year, because I don't think a man who got a 6-year contract with the option of an additional year will necessarily be getting a new one. But maybe he will be if he goes on from strength to strength.
We said last season we praised him because a lot of players in his position would have threw their ties out the pram, and getting your captaincy stripped off you and not playing. I think he played, was it 7 league starts? Was it 8? I think it was 7 last year. And to be such a positive kind of presence around Carrington still, regardless of that playing situation. Yeah. And his role with younger players as well, he's been fantastic. You talk to young players and you see, I think, the rare opportunities that we do get, but they have mentioned Will Fish, for example. He says Harry Maguire was always great around Carrington.
Yeah.
Well, a leader in that regard. And you mentioned his partnership with Kamwala. He's kind of teaching him and kind of pointing him in the right direction. There was a moment when Mainoo was asking where he needed to be, I spotted. So he's brilliant in that sense. I think he's having a really good season. So fair play to Harry Maguire. And I'll get you to give him a 7 by the end of the...
One of the things about that, certainly during the COVID games, was that he was one of the loudest players. And when you're trying to, you know, you reflect that colour, and then you've got this particular demographic online who... I think that's a negative. Oh, he shouts a lot. Oh, he must be good then. You know, all this nonsense.
They've never played football, if that's the case.
Yeah, and I don't think they've either been to it, and I don't think they've ever been to a football match either. Communication is extremely important. And if you're a young defender, Gary Neville said this about Tony Adams, and Tony Adams would say this, that, and the other. Like, he wouldn't stop talking. But sometimes you need that. And the fact that Gary Neville remembered that all those years on from debuting with England in 1995 shows you that it stuck. And then obviously Gary Neville is a guy who cannot stop talking. So it's clearly rubbed off on him a little bit. And if you're Willy Kamwala, you're thrown in, kind of, you're pretty much thrown in at the deep end, coming up against the front line of Diaz, Salah and Nunez. You will want someone who's going to be communicative with you. And they have good communicators. United, Martinez, good character, good communicator. Same with Evans, same with Varane. At centre-half, they've got a lot of grown-ups there. Other areas of the team, it's a little bit more callow or more junior, but they have got a lot of grown-ups there who can certainly, you know, act as an ad hoc mentor for a young defender coming in. And Maguire is good at that. And look, he could easily have been sold in the summer. They accepted that bid from West Ham. But the starting point for him coming into the season, to have had the season that he has had, he has done well, undeniably. He really has. Unfortunately for him, when it's not like he had a run last season where when he started, United always won because he was starting against really, really weak teams in the Europa League or the League Cup.
He did have a very good first two seasons, though. Then...
His first season was very good. His second was decent. And I think he was probably more missed when he didn't play in the second season than when he did. That doesn't make sense. His strengths were more obvious when he wasn't there, because when he wasn't there for the run-in, they didn't look themselves defensively. And he obviously missed the first two games for England at the Euros. Then he came in. He was the best centre-half.
That was the whole talking point leading up to the Europa League final with Solskjaer in charge. It was whether Maguire would be involved, and it was kind of seen as such a big thing leading into that game.
And then he started someone who'd threatened to leave if he wouldn't start, having given him a new contract when they shouldn't have given him a new contract.
He's at the wheel, bro.
But the unfortunately for Maguire, until this season, his line at United, if you were to chart his progress, it'd have just been going and then starting high and then just gradually going lower. And
I was
going
to say, Samuel had to actually explain on podcast form what's doing with his hand, just think of
like the Wall Street crash coming along, and that's what happens to
the
economy.
But it's picking back up again.
It is, yeah, until this season, and the curve has started to go up again. So, in terms of the players who face some uncertainty going in the summer, you would still probably categorise him... A month ago, you'd have probably categorised him as one who would be uncertain. Now, I think he's more certain of staying by virtue of the defenders who they can't really keep because of the brittleness and their contract situation, and other areas of that department who need to go ahead of him. And Lindelof is the one they should be selling now. And Maguire has shown this season, he's not exactly been... an out-and-out first team of this season because he has had injury issues, but when he has played, more often than not, he's done well. He's not had many bad games this season, Absolutely.
Should we make a Wall Street graph for Marcus Rashford then? His career at Man United is just up, 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 and then a bit of turbulence. I think it's fair.
I think crashed is probably an appropriate word.
Well, I mean, it was a big shout to bench him against Chelsea. Probably the correct one, to be fair, to Ten Hag. He kind of came out, as we discussed on the Friday podcast, and said it was actually for rotation. He always felt likely to start this game because it was Liverpool. I thought Anthony was moved back to the bench. Bit in conflict, just a bit of a meh performance for me, Samuel. It didn't really do much to offend or to do anything really that good. Obviously, you mentioned Connor Bradley getting the yellow card, and you thought, go on then, Rashford.
Yeah.
Target him and take advantage of it. Didn't really, did he?
No.
Came off with an injury in the second half, so failed to take his chance, really, and I thought Anthony was quite bright again when he came on.
Yeah, he was quite urgent, and it was eerie, that chance he had in added time was practicing on the same patch of grass as when Ahmad scored at the same end against the same goalkeeper only 3 weeks earlier. But unfortunately for him, he didn't quite get it in the corner. But with Rashford, I mean, it was interesting what Ten Hag said to MUTV before the game, where he pretty much said that if Anthony was more robust, and Anthony's not started that often recently, then he would have started. He didn't say that outright, but he alluded to that. And he said that Rashford really needs to, I can't remember what quote it was verbatim. You sent it, you forwarded it on yesterday, if you want to get that up and just illuminate listeners.
Give us a moment. It's on my Twitter. Should be a bit quicker than that, shouldn't it? But it was an interesting quote, and I did send it straight to you. I've got it right here. Anthony did so good, obviously, against Chelsea. He gave a lot, went deep into his physical outputs, and today Rashford has to show that, especially in a game against Liverpool. That is a game for him. He's one of our leaders. Very interesting comment. And he should have a big impact today.
And Rashford has got a reasonable record against Liverpool. He scored the winner in 2022, scored the winner in 2018 against them. He obviously scored last month in the Cup, and I think he scored in the Cup tie in the fourth round in 2021. And sometimes with these games against local rivals, the biggest rivals, of course, City and Liverpool, I think Ferguson sometimes would do it. He'd play like an academy player, like Nicky Butt, who wouldn't necessarily always be a starter, and because he knew that player could be trusted in that situation. I remember the last game at Main Road, and he actually got it wrong. The Neville brothers had dreadful games, and in hindsight, it looked like he made the wrong call and started in Phil Neville. It was Gary Neville who made the dreadful error that day against Sean Gota. But it felt like, looking at that quote yesterday from Ten Hag, that he was putting it on Rashford because he's a local lad, he's Mancunian, coming up against Liverpool, that he's got to turn it on. He has turned it on before. Let's lay down the gauntlet. Let's see what he can do. And he didn't really do anything. And he got some applause for a pretty committed challenge by the corner flag in the first half. But apart from that, I'm struggling to recall what else he did other than bicker with Hoyland early in the second half when he embarked on a charge down the left, and I don't think he crossed it, or I can't remember how it petered out, but it did peter out, and Hoyland wasn't happy with Rashford. Rashford wasn't happy with Hoyland. And that's not the first time that's happened this season either. There've been a few times where they've bickered over a misunderstanding, or the ball's not come quickly enough for Hoyland. And I don't think there are many United matchgoers, season ticket holders, paying supporters who would be in favour of Rashford being at the club next season. I don't really see a compelling case to absolutely keep him at all costs. I think they have to look at the opportunity to possibly, you know, move him on.
I completely agree, but as we've said, I just can't see it happening.
Because there's not a
for multiple reasons. I mean, we've talked about him kind of being the poster boy of the club. He's just been given a massive new contract, one of the highest earners. Would he want to leave? Would he want a fresh start? Would PSG kind of be interested?
I think if you're told that you can go, and your brother met Paris Saint-Germain officials and used it to your advantage, then I don't think he'd necessarily have any qualms about it. I think if you're put in that position where you're told this is the situation, then you've got to look elsewhere. And he has looked elsewhere before. He has glanced across the channel at Paris Saint-Germain. And that's on United. They've got to be proactive sellers this summer. We've said that for years, but more than ever with the profitability and sustainability rules, they've got to be looking at getting good money with player sales. And of course, selling an academy player means you make a big profit on it. I've only seen one journalist make a very, very flawed case for United not selling Rashford, saying it's what, you know, that they shouldn't be looking at. But it was more a case of looking at the flaw of PSR, which has, you know, put this rule in that that selling an academy player represents 100% profit, and you shouldn't necessarily be encouraging clubs to look at academy players to make ends meet or to avoid losses, which I kind of get, because if you look at Chelsea, their club captain is Reece James. Conor Gallagher is captaining him in their absence. When they're both fit, they both start. Yet they're the two, it seems like, are going to get sold in the summer for to comply with PSR. And I agree that is flawed, but that's not the case with Rashford. A lot of United fans just wouldn't be starting him at the moment. And he wasn't lucky, because it was a brilliant goal, but the timing of that goal against Wolves in February was so important after his night on the tiles in Belfast the week before. And he was playing in front of the away end, and before they could, if they were going to get on his back, it wasn't going to happen, because he got that goal so early on, and they were able to revel in being 1-0 up and kind of like make light of his extracurricular activities. But he just blows too hot and cold. You go back to Solskjaer's first full season, he was talismanic. When he got his back injury in January, that was seen almost as possibly a season ender for United, not Rashford, but for United's hopes of having a successful season. But he ended, fortunately for him, Fernandes came in. Then I think the COVID-19 pandemic worked out in his favour, because he got more game time when the season restarted. Next season, I thought he was pretty average. The numbers were flattering, but the numbers were also misleading. Season after that, his worst yet. Last season, brilliant. This season, the opposite of brilliant.
That's why even last season, the conversation about whether Marcus Rashford is a world-class talent, you say, well, yeah, but you have to string 3 consecutive seasons at least, surely, to be considered in that bracket.
You have to do what Salah
Do it every season, do it every year, turn up, and unfortunately he didn't do it. Last thing in this part then, Samuel, Wan-Bissaka's penalty. I suggested he would probably return to left back, just because logically he played against
Salah
very well against Liverpool in that game in the FA Cup. He did give away that penalty in the closing stages. It always felt like Liverpool were actually going to score, even when it was 2-1. I thought they were likely to get a goal because of the chances they were creating. But it was so frustrating that it came from that.
I don't know, when Salah put that one over the bar after Onana rather unconvincingly shoveled the ball out, you thought maybe this is United's day. And I think there'd have been a hell of a lot of Liverpool fans in the ground who thought, oh Christ, this really is happening again, in a different way, but we're still going to get beaten by this Man United side. And United have conceded 3 penalties in 2 games now. And I know people, my dad is still debating the second bloody penalty against Chelsea, when I'm just like, get over it. Dalot looked guilty as sin as well, the way he reacted. If he doesn't put his arm on Madueke, it's not a penalty, but he tried to throw him off balance. I know there have been penalties given this season there haven't been penalties given this season where there's been a lot more contact, but the whataboutery is pointless, because the officials are all bad in, you know, individualistic ways. I know you trust out that cliche of, oh, Michael Oliver.
I think he's a good referee.
Michael Oliver's our best referee. You know, the Geordie brethren sticking together. I can't stand him.
He's a good referee, but you can't stand him, which is very interesting.
No, I think his grandstanding.
He is the referee trusted with the biggest games, though. That might not say a lot because the standard is so poor.
That's it. And you know, the referee who gave the penalty against Anthony and Dalot last week is Jared Gillett, who of course is the Australian referee. But all 3 of those penalties, there'll be some crackpot United fans out there who don't think any of them are penalties, and I'm just not having it. The one yesterday, it's such a bad tackle. He doesn't even clean him out. And yes, Elliot engineers the contact, he makes sure of it, but it's just daft from Wan-Bissaka.
It's just very clumsy.
I think it's probably even worse than that, because why are you making a sliding tackle like that time? And he's only done it once before as well. I think it was against Watford in his first season that he gave away a penalty by overestimating how far his leg can extend. And he didn't complain about that yesterday. And there's a reason for that, because it was a penalty, even though the contact wasn't as obvious as it appeared at the time. At the time, it just looked like the clearest penalty you could ever see. But it was another daft decision by a United player inside their own area.
I did say I'd start my left back, but you do leave yourself open and at risk, I guess, to mistakes like that. And you are increasing the likelihood of something happening like that when you're playing Wan-Bissaka on that side. We'll leave it there for part two, and we'll be back in a moment for part three. Welcome back to part three of the Manchester Is Red podcast. Now, Samuel Sturgeon Ratcliffe was 10 yards away in the director's box from...
around
the press box. You weren't sitting beside him, because Sam Allardyce was, apparently.
Yeah, I saw Sam Allardyce there from a distance. I think it was a family affair. I think his other half was with him, and his two sons were also...
So he won't be managing Manchester United next season. Supporters will be, well, hopefully not. Supporters will be glad to hear. What do you think Ratcliffe's been thinking? Because he's been at a few games now. Obviously, the Tottenham game in January was his first one. He was at Stamford Bridge on Thursday when we were there, which we expected, because he's based down that way in London. Up north in Manchester on Sunday. What does he think about all this? Because Erik ten Hag's future will not be decided on one game. It will not be decided on one result. It's going to be decided on months of evidence, months worth of performances, and that performance is very fitting of what we've seen all season.
Well, Ratcliffe will delegate to the football figures, if you like, and they need to sort that out, because a couple are on gardening leave. One hasn't even officially that's not been clinched yet. The Dan Ashworth decision. But I think this notion that United's just going to wait for these people to stop tending to their garden and then they'll make a decision on the manager is, I think that's nonsense. I don't see them doing that. You can't do that. You can't just wait around to decide when a manager goes. You've got to, whether it's off the record or informally or formally, however way you want to play it. I mean, they'll have Dan Ashworth's number. They'll be able to make that decision. They'll be able to put a statement out that is professional enough and reflects the due diligence and the audit they've made on whether the manager stays or goes. And that's the territory we're in now. It's in the balance. It's been in the balance for a while, I think, with Ten Hag. But all the evidence would point towards a change in manager this calendar year. I still hesitate to say the summer, because I don't think it's so much the FA Cup, but it would still be difficult. And I also don't think that Ineos will be acting on emotion, but the possible scenario of United winning an FA Cup against Manchester City and scuppering a possible treble for them, having won a trophy last season and reached three finals under Ten Hag, and you look at it in a more sympathetic light, that you can look at it as one way or the other, like there's your goodbye present, or it's right, let's build on this now. You've had your warnings. This is what you've got to do going into next season. We take all this on board, but we're going to impose this on you. This is how recruitment's going to work. You're not getting the final say, as you have had with some of these daft players that you've signed, and we're going to cut you a break here. We agree that it's a 3-year plan, and you deserve to, you know, enter the third year as well. So I can see either scenario playing out, but I still cannot get past. I just don't see him as him being Ineos's man, and it's happened so often when a club gets taken over or a new owner comes in, what happens within a relatively short period of time? The manager changes. That is how it works. And United don't need to be the exception to that. And I think there's still a bit of blind optimism among some supporters. I mean, I spoke to three friends who are season ticket holders. One's of the opinion that he just has to go. One is still in favour of keeping him, and the other one isn't bothered. And that kind of gives you a good gauge of how mixed it is, and how, I think split's the wrong word, because it almost pits both sides against each other. I think United fans are just disagreeing agreeably on the topic. of whether there should be a managerial change. And there's still quite a lot of football this season that could have a bearing on his future. But ultimately, they haven't lost this many games in a season since 89-90. There's still a good chance this will be the worst season for defeats in the Premier League era if they lose one more game. They were on 12 defeats already. They went out of Europe altogether before Christmas. Their League Cup defence ended at the second hurdle with a 3-0 home defeat. I mean, God forbid they lose to Coventry in the FA Cup semi-final. If that happened, then the only reason to bring him back into Carrington would be for him to clear his desk, because that would be utterly disastrous.
You're talking about the potential destination of the season and whether that could be an FA Cup win or an unlikely Champions League qualification spot. But surely the journey matters and how you get into that destination. And the last 8 months, 9 months, it has been so disappointing. There's been a few good moments, a few memorable wins.
Last year, maybe.
Individual displays. Yeah, I mean,
going back to the league, as we said before, the League Cup final.
It peaked after that, Sevilla game. Do you know those last 20 minutes when United were 2-0 up against Sevilla?
Yeah.
That was probably what all went downhill from that moment.
Yeah, they definitely, after the League Cup final, there was a, you look at it overall, and it definitely started with there. But as you say, although they had the dreadful, the dreadful aberration against Liverpool, and there were a couple of iffy results after that, and they were very lucky to get past Fulham in the FA Cup quarterfinal. But then when the season restarted, they beat Everton very easily. They were beating Sevilla very easily, and the season was well back on track. Then they had that late collapse against Sevilla.
2-1 goals.
Yeah. And it was still obviously a very eventful end to the season, but they weren't quite themselves. They eked past Brighton on a penalty shootout, and I think it was during, because did Brighton take the penalty first? They did, didn't they? I think it might have been the fifth penalty that Sabitzer had, and Robert Sanchez should have saved it. I remember thinking at the time that he'd actually saved it at first, and that was how close they came to not getting to the FA Cup final. But they did. Last season, everybody agrees, was a very good season, especially given the starting point, especially to be under a new manager. But that is quite distant now, and you are judged on what you're doing, not what you've done. And unfortunately for them, the fourth game of the season at Arsenal, which was September the 3rd, I think it was, that set the tone for this season. They conceded quickly after scoring. They conceded an added time winner. They conceded two goals. They conceded in quick succession as well. And also, defenders were dropping like flies. That three of those hallmarks surfaced against Chelsea in that late collapse last week. And to continue to repeating those mistakes as often as they have done, there have now been 29 goals in United's games from the 80th minute and onwards in the 90-minute games this season. 15 have gone to the opposition now. United have scored 14. So even that is now not in their favour. They're conceding more late goals than they're scoring. 26 different back fours this season. You don't get to a stat like that through sheer rotten luck. Ten Hag actually said it was 27, and technically it is. I think personnel-wise it's 26, but because Dallow and Wan-Bissaka have played on different flanks, I think it is technically 27 different back fours they've had this season. The fact that he even advertised that was quite, you know, I think he's trying to do it to gain sympathy, but people are looking at it thinking, well, that's on you. You're managing these players. In the last 2 months, four defenders have clearly been rushed back, and then they've got injured in Shaw, Martinez, Varane and Evans. So when you look at the injury situation at the time, and people might think, well, he deserves some sympathy. No, he's culpable for that as well. And as I said, there's a big piece. It's a very balanced piece as well. It's all pieces are, like, takes into account all the context, minutiae and whatnot of the reasons to keep him and the reasons not to keep him. And most of the evidence to sack him is based on this season, which is a big problem for him. I'd say most of the evidence to keep him, it's kind of stuff that feels a bit distant, or it's maybe a little bit tenuous. It's not as compelling, I don't think.
Yeah, you talk about the possibility of Sir Jim Ratcliffe and Ineos Sainwright right have another year. If you haven't doubts over a manager and you've just invested in a club, we've talked about Ratcliffe being a man in a hurry, 71 years old, a lot of money involved here. time, etc. Is it worth persisting with a manager who you've got doubts over when you could start afresh? The potential damage that that does for another year, delays the it could set back the process another 3-4 years by persisting with a manager who isn't right for the project.
Yeah, and that's why I still think there will be a managerial change this calendar year, because, as you said, new owners come in, or new co-owners, new decision makers. That tends to happen. And Ratcliffe he's not backed him. Now, United, quite rightly, are of the opinion that if they give him a vote of confidence, a public vote of confidence, it just fuels more speculation. Because how many times has that happened with other managers and they've been sacked a week later or the next month? I think there are certain managers from different cultures who feel reassurance from that. But in England, there's a reason why we prefix that phrase with the word dreaded.
It's kiss of death, isn't it, sometimes?
It is. It is. And one of the things that is in Ten Hag's favour is, as we've said before, there's not an obvious candidate. When United sacked Moyes, there were candidates galore. When they sacked Van Gaal, it was always going to be Mourinho. When they sacked Mourinho, the consensus was, well, you've got to go to Pochettino now. Didn't work out for him. When they sacked Solskjaer, it was Pochettino again who was seen as obvious candidate. And then when it came to it, it was always going to be Pochettino or Ten Hag. With Ten Hag now, it's, if you're going to sack him, are you getting an upgrade? I think if Ten Hag had more of was a little bit more charismatic in press conferences, if he had a turn of phrase like Mourinho more often, he would have come out with a zinger over the Southgate stuff. Like, he could have said something like, I don't know, if I'm a comms advisor, Ten Hag, you and we get on famously, and I've done my research, you say, I'm not going to have it when a manager's being linked with this role who, the last time he managed a club, I still had hair, or something like that. He'd have got a lot of credit in the bank, I think, certainly from us
Mannerism after seeing that court. It sounds right, doesn't it?
Yeah. But the notion that Gareth Southgate should be replacing him, no United fan is having that.
But you talk about, could there be an upgrade on Ten Hag? And you look at the performances this season, where they're on the league, out of the Champions League, out of the Carabao Cup, it's been awful. Surely there is an upgrade on that.
I know, and that's the point I was probably about to get to, in that you can't use that as an excuse not to sack a manager, because it's your job to really do due diligence and look for a manager who you're confident is going to come in and make an impact and take them on and improve them. As Ten Hag did when he came in and took over from Rangnick after the end of the Solskjaer era. And I don't believe there's not a manager out there that Manchester United... I should rephrase that. There has got to be a manager out there that Manchester United could get and would do a better job. And I'm not saying that, oh yeah, it's Jurgen Klopp because he's available in the summer. Obviously, he's not going to come to United. But they could... I absolutely believe that there is a manager out there who they could hire to replace Ten Hag, and he would improve them. And it's on them, the onus is on them to find out that manager, because they're assessing candidates. We've written that already. It's an established fact. And if they weren't assessing candidates, they wouldn't be worthy of running a football club, because you've always got to be prepared for it. Brighton will absolutely know who's going to come in and replace Roberto De Zerbi in the summer. Or they've got a short list of candidates to replace Roberto De Zerbi lined up, ready to go if or when he decides to go, because it looks like he will do. So and also there are some fans who a little bit idealistic, because United are the club of Busby and Ferguson and those epochs that they had. But you look at Bayern Munich, whose 12-year hegemony in the Bundesliga is about to end. But I looked at the managers who've won the title with them during that time: Jupp Heynckes, Pep Guardiola, Carlo Ancelotti,
Tuchel,
Nagelsmann, the Croatian, was it Kovic?
Did he win the league?
Yeah, he won the league as well. So even someone that people forget, managed by Munich, won the league. And I know it's different in the Bundesliga, but you can change the manager every 2 years. I think there's this there's this misconception from some United fans that you can't just change the manager every 2 or 3 years, but you really can if you get it right and you've got the right structure in place and you've got a good enough squad. And Bayern Munich have been able to do that over the last 11 or 12 years. United are nowhere near that level, obviously. The proof is in the pudding there. But I don't believe that, there's an argument to say it's a 3-year plan, let him enter the third year. But you can't, if he was to enter it on the back of the second year, he would be lucky, because the second year has been pretty appalling so far.
And the counterpoint, I guess, to the managerial argument would be, well, look, we've done that in the last 10 years since Sir Alex Ferguson retired. It's not worked. So some supporters are saying, let's persist with Ten Hag. Bayern Munich might have changed managers and won titles, but Man United have done it and they've not won titles.
Yeah.
Unfortunately. It's Bournemouth on Saturday later in the week. We will have a preview podcast, a proper one, later on. But it's Coventry after that. I've talked about kickoff time quite a lot, and a smaller club, Man United, coming to town, 5:30 PM. Bournemouth are going to be massive up for that, and it could be a banana skin.
Well, it could, because they were exceptional at Old Trafford in December, and they've got some very good players, underrated players, but then they lost 2-1 at the weekend to Luton, and I think when they were lining up the BBC guide, it was kind of like billing it as, almost being a foregone conclusion Bournemouth would win. I thought, well, Luton will probably win this now. That's what happened in the end. But United don't win games easily. When they do win them, they, as I said to you yesterday, they are like Livia Soprano, always with the drama. And there was more drama yesterday. So if they could have a quiet win, that would be most appreciated.
Wrapped up at halftime would be good for
I can't see that happening, unfortunately. I think that's only happened twice this season, against probably Palace in the League Cup and Everton in the league. It didn't even happen at Newport or even Wigan. They were only 1-0 up at Wigan in the FA Cup. But yeah, with that game, it doesn't feel like there's a great deal riding on it. They need to sustain momentum in the league, whatever happens, because the chances are they will have an FA Cup final to play for, and this is their last game before the semi-final against Coventry.
It's going to be an interesting fixture. I think we all feared the worst for Coventry coming out of Stamford Bridge, and then the Liverpool performance, does it change that much? I don't know, but they're going to have to play better. Not a bad side, Coventry.
Did you fear the worst for United against Coventry? I'm not as pessimistic as you.
Well, you can say, lads, surprise. It's Coventry.
Yeah, we shall see.
Thanks for your time, Samuel.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening. As usual, have a great week. We'll see you on Friday. Take care.